decades seem like such official markers of time periods. When somebody mentions the 1920s or the 60s or the 80s, we can conjure the zeitgeist even if we weren't around to witness it. But we also understand that decade markers are entirely arbitrary, that eras as cultural symbols might not coincide precisely with the dates on the calendar. Take the decade we sometimes refer to as the aughts. For my guest, it was a time marked by a kind of shameless meanness that outlasted those first years of this millennium by more than 10 years. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Christian Vistrup Madsen is a writer based in Berlin. His essay for The White Review is called Chains or Whips, The Cruel Decade and Its Aftermath. It explores the way pop culture shaped our perception of the world in the 2000s and set us up for where we are now. Christian, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We should start with this idea that while the start and end of a decade may be decisive on a calendar, the cultural and historical feeling we ascribe to decades can be a lot more slippery, right? As you write, nothing is ever over when it's over. It's only over much later.
Yeah, I think partly that has to do with simply being sort of in the thick of it, being quite overwhelmed. You know, we're used to this logic from all kinds of spheres, right? Like art history or something we don't know until much later, like what were actually the tendencies that lasted. And it's not very easy to see things clearly when you're in them. I think what I'm also getting at in the piece is that I was of a particular age, like becoming a teenager, becoming an adult during those years. And so there's this kind of added element of being so exposed and not really having maturity to sort of filter experiences through. And so that also means that the sort of perception of what happened is weirdly delayed.
Yeah, I understand that. And it's also, you know, the kind of loss of innocence that happens as anybody comes of age and no longer has older generations kind of protecting you from harsh realities, that can compound the effects of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess it's also a question of trauma is a big word, but kind of being quite shook or something, you know, then you're also not quite able to do anything else in that moment, but survive in a way. And I guess that also leads to this hypothesis that I advance with the next decade after being a kind of decade of survivors.
We can't necessarily tell how long the influence of events will last, right? A thing can happen and be done, but it still shapes how we view the world and how we behave. I think about, you know, for Americans, the 9/11 attacks all happened in a single morning, but their grip on us lasted for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I found a strange, like for me, 9/11, of course, but Afghanistan and Iraq, and then coming from Denmark, also these Muhammad cartoons that unleashed this enormous spectacle in the media. All these things that took up so much space in my imagination and in my idea of the world, and then kind of in a strange way disappeared. And I feel like in the last few years, as I write with the withdrawal of the NATO soldiers from Afghanistan, there's suddenly a sense that, like, maybe even collectively, we're starting to begin to look at these things again.
How did you start thinking of this period as the decade of cruelty? At what point did you begin to get some clarity on that?
So I've worked for the last 7 years or so as an art critic. And so I've always been sort of following very closely what happens in culture and trying very quickly to write it down and find words for it, like trends and, I don't know, zeitgeist kind of stuff, right? And so for years, I've had this, I've been having these conversations with people around me and with Rosanna McLaughlin, who was the editor for this piece, and who also edited a book that I wrote a few years ago. We've been having these conversations around morality and victimhood and identity politics and trying to kind of understand how those things were playing out in the art world, how to relate to those as critics. when there was a kind of shift from like actually being in favor of a certain kind of politics, but realizing that you weren't really able to sort of work within it in a critical way. That experience of the last 10 years and trying to find words for what I describe in the essay as a type of masochistic logic, that kind of came before, weirdly, and led me into this kind of led me to this conclusion of cruelty, or to begin to think of the opposite. Where did this come from? Why did we react, the millennials, so strongly to certain things starting from around 2012? Where did this return of feminism and queer discourse and all these things, where did it come from?
This essay is fascinating because it takes on things that are clearly consequential, like the presence of US and NATO troops in Afghanistan, and it also takes on things that might at first glance appear frivolous but stood in for a lot more. So, like, this decade and its unkindness can also be marked by the arrival of low-rise jeans. Talk us through that because it makes perfect sense in context.
I think it has to do with the like wars and like n news items, as well as like fashion and advertisement and music and reality TV. They all kind of they're all on the same sort of platform, right? Of mass media and an image spectacle. So I think they all sort of sit next to each other in the same way that we have many different tabs open on our computers, right? And I think, for instance, with the low-rise jeans, I call it like fashion without space for vital organs or something like that. That there was a kind of cruelty there too, that it comes back to how we understood bodies and gender and how to behave and look in public. So I think those things are really, they are really connected, and not in frivolous ways. They're also things that act as clues for each other or something.
You also remind us of John Galliano's infamous dress, made to look like it was made of newspaper. What was his inspiration there?
So I believe that his inspiration was homeless people living in the street and often lying like on stacks of old newspapers, or using newspapers in different ways to create a space to sit or something, right? And then he maybe has seen that and thought, oh, how about we make that chic, you know? And obviously, how I came across that, I think, was like years ago on some like Instagram post or something that was participating in what I also describe as this kind of retrial of cultural products from the 2000s, which would bring up like outfits that Carrie wore, and then talk about where those outfits came from, and it years later, of course, it spawned this whole discussion about was that okay? And wow, I can't believe he did that. There were so many things where 10 years later we looked back and thought, I can't believe that someone did that. And of course, with Galliano, he's also a figure who, for other reasons, became problematic since, but who really has a very central place in fashion in the 2000s.
When you say things that Carrie wore, you're talking about the character Carrie Bradshaw from Sex and the City. And this was a character who was always portrayed as the epitome of chic, and at no point really punished for her opportunism and selfishness and, in some ways, lack of seriousness.
Yeah, or I mean, I think she was very serious, but she was very serious about herself, right? Like it's sort of you watch that show now and you think, like, why would anybody want to be friends with her? You know? She has this like gay friend who's like trying to get her attention, and she never asks him any questions about his own life or something. You know, it's there's something. I watched an episode recently again and was kind of shocked at how it's sort of TikTok-like. It's like it's so fast-paced. Every scene is so short. Everything is reduced to a sort of slogan or something, and then there are adverts, you know, like also re-remembering that how we used to see those shows with was interrupted by adverts every like 7 minutes or something, right? So there's yeah, sorry, to come back to Carrie as a character, there no one wanted for characters to necessarily be nice on TV. We wanted them to be chic and unattainable. It wasn't about relatability exactly, I think.
I actually Googled the Galliano dress that was featured on Sex and the City, made to look like it was made out of newspapers, this morning because I didn't remember it. And I discovered that the fast fashion company Shein is currently selling a version of this for $9.49. I didn't know what to think about that, except that maybe we are not out of this moment even now.
I mean, I think that it's part of the what I had to think through as well in this essay, that we are running everything through the mill again, you know, and I think in fashion it's especially obvious, like in the last 2 years, seeing how the teenagers now dress exactly as teenagers dressed in 2003 or even 2005. It gets closer and closer, and they get better and better at it. Maybe also because they have access to old pictures or something, but there is something kind of morbidly stagnant about our culture at the moment where we just keep repeating ourselves. And then maybe we will change the politics almost in the way that someone would like change a lipstick or something, like this time make it feminist or this time with the right discourse. But it's as if our culture has kind of run out of imagination and we're doing things on repeat.
Yeah, and that repetition is troubling. I had a conversation with a music critic a few months ago, and he had real concerns that because we can always access music instantaneously that we want to hear, people, including young people, are paying a lot more attention to older music, and newer music has a much harder time sort of rising to the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine that. And in a way, it's kind of, you know, usually would, like, this interest in historical cultural artifacts is weirdly accompanied at the same time with a feeling of amnesia, that people don't seem to remember that, like, oh, but we just did this, or this was just said by these other people or something, that there's a weird contradiction going on, I feel. And maybe it's to do with the shallowness of the engagement with history, that something is kind of adopted as an image, but not really, or as a soundbite in music or something, but not really sort of understood or engaged with on a deeper level.
And of course, when we continue to repeat things, but, you know, the only change that we make is an inherent criticism of the way we did it the last time around, that sets everyone up for feeling terrible, except maybe, you know, the youngest generation of young adults who can't be blamed for the way it was done badly the last time around.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I guess in this piece, what I'm allowing myself to be a little bit nostalgic for is not feeling bad or something.
Yeah.
Like is an intellectual climate that asks people to kind of take responsibility or something rather than to like pay their debt by feeling guilty. Or even not take responsibility, but like take a stance or like have a different opinion or something.
So Christian, let's talk about one particular it girl of the 2000s, Britney Spears. Her story is fascinating, even if we never really became fans of the music. I mean, she started life as a child performer on the new Mickey Mouse Club. Then she had her image transformed. She was someone, I think, who could reasonably said to have been used as a product by the adults in her life from long before she had any say in the matter.
Yeah, I describe her position as someone who appeared at a kind of changing of the guards, where there was all this technology and all this kind of this the type of media landscape that could produce a sort of a young pop superstar in the way that she was produced, but not yet the kind of cushions or something like that that we've since developed. Pop stars in the last decade, like Taylor Swift or Ariana Grande or people like that, have been able through Twitter and social media, and through other kinds of discourses to take more, to protect themselves more, to speak for themselves in a sense. And with Britney, it was like she was everybody's sort of, it was a kind of test run or something. What happens if we throw this child into this like sea of sharks? Yeah, I mean, I was always fascinated by her, and remember kind of 10 years ago in university starting to like, actually I wrote my first essay about Britney Spears and about what happened after she cut her hair off and was kind of it was at the VMAs in 2008 or 2009 when she kind of had to appear again and she seemed like a zombie and there was this kind of collective loss of innocence or something, like the kind of madness of this show still being on the road even though the protagonist had already died. Or like, and it was interesting to see that then in the years that followed, this attention just grew and grew and grew, and now it's almost been like, I think that her reception, I almost said posthumous, but I just mean retrospective.
Yeah.
Her retrospective reception in the last 3, 4 years is almost weighs as heavily in the history of her as her music and the time when she became famous.
How was her image set up to juxtapose innocence and sexuality?
A good question, and I think maybe Americans will know better or understand better. I think to me she was always very exotic. I didn't know I about school uniforms and high school culture from a firsthand experience. I remember once she was interviewed by a Danish journalist for TV, and it was kind of interesting when someone from America comes, they send the most famous journalist to interview them, even if it's a 16-year-old girl. And he asked her what she was going to vote, who she was going to vote for in the election, I suppose, if she could have voted. This was probably the first time George Bush ended up being elected, and she answered that she was just gonna that she just believed in what her parents believed. And that she respected her parents and she respected God. And I think that in that sense, it was her image is so much wrapped up in this kind of Bush era conservatism and patriotism and Christianity. Her innocence that was set up to be defiled is like absolutely a kind of conservative product.
So, in a certain sense, she was a kind of modern-day Lolita figure, but at least in Nabokov's novel, a careful read demonstrates that the bad guy is Humbert Humbert, even though he indulges in self-pity throughout the work. We were not necessarily inclined to interrogate whether we had any culpability in Britney Spears' transformation into something people could both disapprove of, I think, and take a prurient interest in at the same time.
That has been the question of the recent years, like who is responsible, you know? Like something that I kind of get to in the essay is that there was this feeling that there was a kind of monstrous apparatus that was sort of running rampant, and no one really was able to stop it. Not the paparazzi were not at fault. Her management was not at fault. The audience could not possibly be at fault. Why could no? Why was no one able to stop? And in a way, it's like it, I guess it is just it's kind of indulgent libertarianism, the invisible hand market or something. Like no one is actually in control. It's just nature, almost the force of nature that brought this woman down. And probably culture will always need those figures. But I just think the way that we've used her again in the last 3, 4 years. I mean, it's also now a type of instrumentalization, but now she's turned into a kind of pariah, or now the emotions that are attached to her are different. But it's interesting that it's still a matter of projecting onto an image.
I think it's been remarkable to see people who were fine to criticize her and sort of laugh at her emotional problems, now standing up to defend her and sort of recognizing that she wasn't to blame in all of that. It's an interesting, I mean, maybe that more compassionate position is a better one, but it is an interesting turnaround, right, for the way people view her.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly a more compassionate position. But something that I also sort of get to in the essay is discussing these Diane Sawyer interviews and this time when famously she made Britney cry.
You've had a year that would test a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Illness in the family.
Mm-hmm.
A breakup. This spasm of publicity about what happened in from Mexico to London.
It was pretty rough. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Ah, weird. Hello.
Oh my goodness. Hello. Ew. Strong Brittany. Yeah, it was a weird time. Ew. I'm embarrassed. Can we stop?
And there has since been a kind of a reckoning with this, let's say, and just something on a personal level that I kind of felt about this is that Diane Sawyer was also a serious journalist. I mean, there was this sense in which she believed that she was speaking to an adult, and I guess that I sort of allow myself in the piece to suggest. Or to kind of miss that, you know, to not speak down to people as if they were always victims or always giving space for us to feel bad for them or to be compassionate, but actually to ask something of them. Hmm. There is something there. There's this kind of professionalism and impersonality, which contains dignity.
You also remind us in this piece of another young woman who we held up as having engaged in appalling behavior, Lindy England. Some people will remember she was the 21-year-old soldier photographed looking gleeful about the abuse of detainees at Abu Ghraib. Lindy England's defense was she was just sort of following orders. She, though, became the target of our horror and disdain rather than the command structure that encouraged that kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. God, to revisit this whole Abu Ghraib thing, which again is one of those things that I feel like images that really kind of, they are, I think for me as much as the 9/11 pictures, they are the images of that decade in a way, and so incredibly cruel. And how I came to them again was actually that they were part of a big exhibition in Berlin last year, where then the artist was completely kind of slammed afterwards for exposing people to these pictures, and just to think that back then those pictures were really circulating, and no one was really talking about whether or not we should have been exposed to them. This is a little bit of a different matter than what you mentioned, but absolutely, I feel like in the last decade we have been able to cultivate more of the kind of discourse that would allow us to direct ask for responsibility to the people who are in charge. I think that this is what we've seen in some of the debates around, say, like. The Whitney Biennial or something where people are saying, oh, we can't have this person on the board of the Whitney because their money comes from selling arms or things like these that we are somehow able now more to have these structural, to deal with things on a structural level.
Was there something particularly shocking, do you think, about the fact that Lindy England was a young woman? I think there were young men also photographed in similar ways, but she's the one that everyone seems to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe it's a kind of like knee-jerk thing that culture does. Women are always chastised more so than men for whatever they do, whether it's being too beautiful or too ugly or too cruel or too nice.
You also note the 2000s were a time of, and I love this phrase, unabashed obscenity on television. How did MTV kind of position itself at the forefront of this with its reality programming?
I'm not sure. I haven't, like, it's interesting, though. There's another piece to be written by someone who's more of a kind of a cultural studies person, I think, about why so much attention was taken away from music and kind of put on to these, like obscene, like, reality shows, like, really one after the next. It was, like, looking back, it was... It performed the role almost that social media does today with some of the kind of carnage that we find in the more kind of dark depths of social media.
Yeah, I mean, the rise of reality television as a kind of cultural touchstone certainly gave rise to the era of influencers, and those with enough visibility could sell glimpses into their private lives for cash, so like wedding photos, baby photos. But we also found ways to punish anybody not seen as sufficiently famous enough to cash in. So that played out in different ways for people like Jennifer Lopez and Christina Aguilera, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think what's interesting about the exact same thing happened with reality TV and with these kind of, the way that people were treated on reality TV shows, the way that celebrities were treated in paparazzi culture or in kind of magazine culture. The same thing is happening to them that happened now to Britney, that now we're looking at relaunching many of the same reality TV shows from that period, like Paradise Hotel or the Temptation Island or The Bachelorette or something like these types of shows, but now kind of marketing them as in some way like emancipatory or wholesome or adding queer people or adding more of these kind of empowerment narratives that we know from, like, say, RuPaul's Drag Race. So it's interesting that the whole kind of, the whole relationship to celebrities has kind of flipped. And I wonder if it doesn't have something to do with the fact that we've all got a chance to be celebrities for ourselves on Instagram, or that somehow the logic of the celebrity now kind of in small ways applies to everybody. We're all selling our own image.
You know, it's interesting, Christian, because I think there is the perception and remotely the possibility of, right, of any one of us becoming famous on social media based on what we post. But it's unlikely for the vast majority of people. And, you know, in the United States, we're starting to grapple with this myth of meritocracy, that if you just work hard and do everything right, you definitely will find success. We're recognizing that's not true for huge swaths of the population. And I feel like this idea that anybody can be famous in some ways is an extension of that, right? If you just post enough content to Instagram, you will enjoy all the benefits of your favorite celebrities.
Yeah, but I mean, weirdly, this influencer culture has become so pervasive, and I think people really do believe in it because the affirmation is instantaneous. You don't need 100,000 followers. You could also have 5,000. Another thing that I was kind of that I returned to when I was writing this essay was like remembering how difficult it was to get a picture of yourself in the 2000s. That you really weren't kind of allowed to take one yourself. It would be so shameless, shameful, in a sense. And this switch onto the selfie as something that is not a type of like narcissism, but a mode of self-empowerment. I think that cultural turn, which probably happened around 2013, 14, really. Like that is part of this way that we've started to look at ourselves as celebrities, not in terms of being actually famous, but somehow in terms of seeing ourselves a little bit from the outside as image packages.
Hmm. Well, you touch on the fact that the ideal photo to post of oneself on social media is one that appears to have been taken by someone else, as if you are so beloved and irresistible that you are being followed around by photographers the way celebrities are.
Yeah, and in a sense, there we can see that maybe there was always, you know, that this kind of celebrity logic in terms of how we self-style it, it's an older one. But of course, when celebrities now also take their own picture rather than being necessarily followed by paparazzi, so we changed with them.
Yeah, because I mean, plenty of bad pictures can also be taken by people who are unaware that they're being photographed. And, you know, a cruel culture delights in those as much as it delights in the beautiful pictures of people.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, we don't see a lot of those bad pictures anymore, you know? Like, not of our friends, not of ourselves, and not even of celebrities. Like, all these pictures that would always be of someone in Hollywood, like, with their G-string out, or, like, I don't know, like, with a double chin or something. Like, they don't surface so much.
So, Christian, as a millennial, you are also a member of the first generation for whom regular people had a whole lot of photos posted online of themselves without their consent. I mean, even if in the beginning they were taken and posted by doting parents and grandparents, it's like people your age were socialized to understand this might be beyond your control.
And I think that I very quickly kind of understood that. I think perhaps also partly because of being gay, I was very wary growing up of like these kind of basically the public sphere, which is what at that time, also before filter bubbles, internet culture was really kind of modeled on. And I very quickly kind of burnt myself and realized that like, okay, it's actually very limited, or it is, as you say, out of my control. The kind of participation that I can do here, or because it's going to quickly backlash. So I've actually most of my life kind of been pretty reserved in that way, and even now don't have Instagram, for instance, or really use social media. But a lot of people have found it the other way around, that they have been able to use these networks to find exactly who they want to present themselves to and who they want to exchange with. But I think that it was easy back then to really burn yourself because the technology was so new and no one really knew how to deal with it.
You note in the piece the extraordinary prevalence of anxiety diagnoses in the 20-teens, sometimes used as you say, a badge of honor rather than just a challenging fact of individual lives. What do you think that was about? That sense that anxiety is something that people reclaimed as, if not something to be proud of, something that they are refuse to be ashamed of.
I'm thinking not so much about that people should be ashamed, but maybe rather what is implied by sort of adding these diagnoses and this language to one's own identity. There's something kind of essentialistic about it, as if to say this is who I am, and that will never change. And also to kind of almost infer implicitly that there are people who are completely without, you know, like that there are people who are just normal, that life for anybody is just completely simple. Like, I don't think you would have to have many meetings with a psychiatrist or something, like any of us, before we could kind of achieve some sort of diagnosis, which then we could sort of go around and like take up space with or something. Of course, this is different for different people, but there was a kind of, it was definitely a new logic in the 2010s, that this could be, yeah, that this could be something to, yeah, that this could be a type of empowerment.
I suppose it's easier to own that empowerment than it is to attempt to change a culture that contributes to so much psychic distress.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I understand why it's come about. And then the question is just, I think, and I think it was good, you know, this backlash, or let's say this turn has been absolutely necessary. But I think kind of coming into a new decade, some of the questions we can now kind of ask ourselves is also like, where does that leave us as individuals to have identified so much with our problems and with our pain and with the extent to which we could be said to be a victim of one thing or another, because I think that can also leave you actually more vulnerable or more kind of like stuck as a human being on an individual level, even though on a structural political level, it absolutely sounds like a good idea.
You know that this era was obsessed with minimalism. How did minimalism curdle into its own form of consumerism?
Yeah, I describe these kind of all these home decor shows that were about throwing things out. that there was this kind of great feeling, a little bit opposite to what we were talking about earlier, that now everyone is looking back and kind of looking at old music and old whatever. There was this feeling that everything that came from the last century was kind of awful, and that we needed to kind of rid ourselves of those things and get new stuff, and that we would have these like shiny white kitchens with nothing else inside, and these like sort of cartel plastic accessories. And maybe it changed a bit. There was also definitely a big like retro trend in the 2000s, but I think in the piece I associated also with the skinny jeans and this kind of let's say sort of skeletal aesthetic, that there was this, maybe it was also the numerics simply of the new millennium that made us think we could make everything new, we could start over. And that's also a type of minimalism.
Yeah, and with this minimalism, we had not just the policing of body size, but frankly, a lot of moralizing around it. You know, we celebrate the biggest losers of weight for, I guess, finally following society's rules around what is seen as acceptable.
Yeah, and this is also quite wild to look back on the things that could be said in these TV shows. A lot of these sort of Ricky Lake style shows where we would see a very young person say like lose weight, and then everyone would applaud, and it was just sort of every afternoon on TV for everybody to see. And I guess that this, on the one hand, there was this obsession with obesity and wanting to see that and shame that. And then on the other hand, this fashion for anorexia. Hmm.
Now we're in this moment. I don't know whether this medication has reached Germany, but in the United States, there are these drugs that were first prescribed for diabetes, and they turn out to work really well for weight loss. And we're in this whole new moment where people can't decide how to feel about those and about people who lose weight on these drugs. It seems as if there's a movement that says somehow it's cheating to use these medications, even if you use them to, you know, finally submit to the pressure that society's put on you to make your body look a certain way.
I think I don't know about these drugs specifically, but it's interesting that it goes a little bit hand in hand with the recent embrace in I think quite mainstream culture of plastic surgery. That's also something which previously would have been seen as shameful or kind of something that you would try and hide. You would try and do it so that you wouldn't, no one would hopefully notice. But the amount of people in their 30s, normal people, or what's a normal person, people that I know, are like, so many people are now getting plastic surgery, getting lips, getting all kinds of things. It's normal. And I feel like another thing from the 2000s that went with this idea that you weren't really allowed to take your own photo is that you were supposed to be somehow kind of authentic. And or there was a kind of like leftover idea maybe from the 20th century of authenticity or something, which I think largely now there's a kind of it's totally acceptable to have plastic surgery to kind of manufacture yourself online through selfies, and maybe also to now you say that there is this discussion around the like whether it's okay to lose weight like with help or something, but I think probably people will come to the conclusion via this rhetoric of emancipation and empowerment that this is a way for people to become their best selves or something. And then if a pharmaceutical company can make some money in that process, that's just bonus.
I mean, authenticity is a hard word to even, you know, describe and pin down. I wonder if we really are liberated by this sense that we don't need to try for authenticity, or if we lose something in giving up on that as a project.
Yeah, I wonder about that too. I'm not really sure that I believe in this emancipation that comes with being able to take your own photograph. I think that there's also alienation in that, and that there's maybe a loss of dignity too. That this kind of constant self-promotion and self-presentation that happens online, that it's really it's something which in previous generations, previous decades would have been considered, like, I think almost sort of vulgar or something, you know? And you could say, oh yeah, that's old fashioned and it's probably religious and it's conservative and it comes with all these bad ideas that we don't like anymore. But there's also something about it. Like, we don't, if we give up on some of those things, like there's not, like we can't really get them back, and there's not much else to human life. Like, this is it, you know? We have to hold on to our dignity. I think dignity should be a kind of new fashionable word in the decade to come, I hope.
Our relentless exposure to cruelty in the first years of this century doesn't seem to have made us tougher in the face of it. In some ways, it created what you call a kind of phobia around discomfort. How has that affected our ability to really communicate with one another?
I think that a lot of people have become very shy of conflict. And there I also reference in the essay a book by Sarah Schulman, which came out maybe about 5 years ago, called Conflict Is Not Abuse, which had a very sort of ambivalent reception. And she tries to argue in that book that that there is a kind of zeitgeist, or there's a moment where when people kind of stopped being able to handle any kind of conflict, and therefore would respond to it as if it was abuse, and that maybe it's to do with filter bubbles, social media. Like, there are all kinds of theories as to why, but I think that there's something to that argument that she made.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if we're always encouraged to think about how anything affects us first and foremost, it's hard not to read any kind of disagreement as abusive or belligerent.
Yeah, I mean, I've come across this in my work as an art critic as well, where, like, I think in a fundamental sense, the sort of the definition of art criticism is to sort of have a conversation about works that is supposed to be sort of challenging and maintain a certain standard for artworks. But I've found sometimes that the subjects of my criticism, the artists or the galleries or whoever put on the exhibitions, assumed that the criticism would be a form of affirmation, basically like how on social media it is not possible to dislike something, you can only double click to like, you know, that there is a kind of like, and with these pieces of criticism, I am not trying to bring somebody down. I'm not trying to cancel them. I'm trying to kind of maintain a certain level in the field, you know? And I think this is the point where maybe like conflict, and or not even conflict, but simply disagreement or discernment is understood sometimes as a form of abuse.
Does declaring the end of a decade or a period of the zeitgeist mean we have moved beyond that way of thinking? Like, does recognizing the cruelties of the 2000s position us to respond to them by choosing a more benevolent way of being in the world moving forward?
I think that we've gone for benevolence in the last decade. And now we're kind of getting to grips with maybe some of the negative sides of benevolence, which can be sort of a herd mentality or a sentimentality or plain sort of thoughtlessness. People only going by a sort of a sense of morality or something, and not really thinking. And I think that that this is something that we hopefully will will move more towards a kind of that we can start to have more conversations. I think it's already happening, like conversations that were not taking place just 2 years ago or something are starting to happen more now. I think we're getting used to disagreement, and we're getting used to kind of basically having a type of public sphere again.
Christian Vistrup Madsen is a writer based in Berlin. His essay for The White Review is called Chains or Whips, The Cruel Decade and Its Aftermath. Christian, thank you so much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or catch up at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.